Select your program.
Philosophy.
Program initiated. Approach the threshold. Engage rationality. Open your mind. Godspeed.
Darting past Alpha Centauri through our solar system to your listening devices, this is Flagship Freedom, the podcast that places you on the front line in the war of ideas. My name is Michael, and welcome to the cast. As I told you maybe two or three episodes ago, Danny and I will be creating a lot of content separately, and this is the beginning of the creation of a lot of our separate content. With my move coming up out of Michigan to another city, I will be very busy, and my schedule will be very difficult to be able to coordinate that with Danny, so it might be a couple weeks, three or four, until I settle into my new location, where we will be finally able to coordinate a tag team podcast hosting once again. So in the meantime, be patient with us and enjoy the large amount of content that will be coming your way ever soon. So before I introduce to you our next guest, I wanted to ask all of you that if you enjoy our podcast and the contents that we create, please consider subscribing to us on whatever listening devices you care to be using, PC, tablet, phone, and whatever program that you're using to interact with our content, whether it be iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, even on YouTube. Subscribe to our channel. And more subscriptions means more people like you may be able to find our stuff. And that's helpful to them, and that's helpful to us, so that we can continue to grow our humble little podcast. We have already done some great things, and we have grown to over 2,000 unique listeners per episode. I am thrilled to be able to say that, and I know Danny is too. Our guest today is Professor Daniel K. Williams of the University of West Georgia, and he is the author of an exciting, fairly new book called The Defenders of the Unborn, The Pro-Life Movement Before Roe versus Wade. Now, listeners, you may or may not know that I am actually anti-abortion. Suppose I'm in the minority when it comes to the libertarian movement, the Libertarian Party, and I have been this way for quite some time. My position has always been a secular one, and we are hoping to actually do several more pieces on the abortion debate, and perhaps I will be able to expound upon my beliefs so that you understand where I'm coming from. It's always been a matter of contention within the liberty movement, and you'll often hear, as there was a picture recently released at a protest at the Women's March, I think, that pro-choice everything is the stance of the Libertarian Party. So you can understand why sometimes I feel alienated and isolated from the party in that regard, but I am vehemently against abortion, and I hope to explore that in some of the coming episodes. But in the meantime, I invited Professor Williams on to talk about his book and to shed some light on something that I think that both anti-aborts and pro-aborts will find very interesting, and that is the history of the pro-life movement. Now, I'm not going to spoil too much of it, but to say that once you are very familiar with politics as well as history and how these things have shifted over time, particularly the politics, we are then not so surprised, rather confirmed in our suspicions that a two-party politics is really just a shell game. And as Andrew Breitbart once said, it's just downstream from culture. When culture shifts, so does politics. So when I say culture, I mean morality, I mean scientific discovery, globalism. A lot of these things affect culture. When you slam cultures next to one another in the age of the internet, you have a lot of really interesting things that happen. Politics will be affected by a lot of these shifts and these changes in this new age of technology and globalization. So if you look back historically, the Republican Party used to be called the Party of Lincoln, and some people still do, but it doesn't resemble anything like that anymore. and comprised in large parts of Black Americans who unflinchingly supported the party up until maybe the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement and LBJ's Great Society. And Lincoln himself was not a small government sort of person. He extended the reach of the executive branch by miles and miles compared to many other presidents before him. And then you have people like Teddy Roosevelt, who was not at all a small government sort of person and really never met a war he never wanted to fight. And then on the other side, on the Democrat side, you had men like Woodrow Wilson, who was a KKK sympathizer, and Southern Democrats like Robert Byrd, who were members of the KKK and had very much difficult time unburdening themselves later in their years when the Dems suddenly became civil rights activists. So while you are listening to the conversation, I want you all to keep in mind that what was once Republican may be Democrat now, and what was once liberal may now be conservative. Culture shifts, politics shift, the pro-life movement and the abortion debate overall is not immune to this. The right-to-life movement comprised of Black Americans and women and anti-war veterans and New Deal Dems and liberal Protestants. A crazy shift from what happened in 1973 and what happened after, when all of that was galvanized and housed really into the Republican Party. So I hope all of you enjoy the conversation with Dan, and as always, love to hear your feedback. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Professor Daniel K. Williams, Associate Professor of History at the University of West Georgia. He is the author of God's Own Party, The Making of the Christian Right, and his newest book, Defenders of the Unborn, The Pro-Life Movement Before Roe versus Wade, which was published, I believe it was the beginning of last year. Correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, but welcome to the flagship Freedom.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here, Michael.
All right, great. Well, I'm really excited about this conversation. We really haven't tackled the issue of abortion on this program, but really, this is going to be kind of a multi-part piece, beginning with the history of the pro-life movement, which is precisely what Professor Williams has written about in his book. Now, I found this book to be really a one-of-a-kind thing. It's chock full of so much information that it's heretofore been scattered and obscured. Your methodical attention to detail and documented almost every year by year policy and public opinion of the pro-life movement. It was really enriching, and I think it's going to be enriching to a lot of people that end up picking this book up and that really care about stories that have been buried by time and political subversion. Sometimes even there is a central claim in this book, which I really want to make the subject of the conversation, maybe the touchstone of the conversation, that I found really to be enlightening. I thought it was surprising, and maybe it's misleading for some people that aren't familiar with history. And the claim is that far from, you know, a reactionary Christian right movement like the pro-choice movement wishes to portray, the years leading up to the Watershed Decision of 1973 were anything but a monolithic Catholic protest. There were New Deal Dems and progressive liberals and African Americans, anti-war protesters, and surprise, surprise, women, really. And this flies in the face of everything that traditional narrative really allows. So I know your intention as a historian is to explore and report facts, but there are some that may read your book, and they may read it because they want to gain ammunition against contemporary liberals and say, look at you hypocrites. You used to support abortion restrictions, but politics shift very often, and it would be difficult to draw that as the only lesson in this book. So I'm kind of flipping this conversation on its head and beginning with the question of what kind of lessons are you hoping that, pro-abort and an anti-abort and an unaffiliated individual should or could draw from your work?
Right. I think that's a wonderful question. And I think you're right in saying that it's a surprising story. It's a story that is going to surprise pro-lifers, and it's certainly going to surprise most pro-choicers. I think most pro-lifers, at least as far as I've been able to tell, that that this would be true primarily of people who are, say, under the age of 60. But if we take that group, if we take the youngest baby boomers and certainly all of the Gen Xers and the millennials, and we talk about those pro-lifers, they tend to assume that the pro-life movement has always been associated with conservatism. And, even more so, they think that conservatives have always been pro-life. And so the fact that Ronald Reagan signed an abortion liberalization bill, or that some of the conservative heroes of the 1960s, such as Barry Goldwater, were pro-choice, will surprise some pro-lifers. But the even greater surprise in this book, I think, comes for most pro-choicers. And that is that the pro-life movement originated, as I see it, as a liberal human rights movement. And you're quite right that in the early 1970s, large numbers of African Americans, including some civil rights activists like Jesse Jackson, as well as a number of women, were very firmly pro-life. Some of the most liberal members of the Senate, including Ted Kennedy in the early 1970s, identified themselves with the pro-life movement.
Right.
And even more so, the pro-life movement used explicitly liberal language in grounding its cause. There was a link between the pro-life movement and the anti-war movement, as you mentioned. There was this concern for the protection of all life, including the lives of minorities, including lives of people who were overlooked by the mainstream. And many pro-lifers viewed themselves as protectors of the defenseless, something that very much caused them to view themselves as in solidarity with liberals. And so
right.
the story that I tell, as you said, is a story of shifting political allegiances, shifting ideologies. And so at the beginning of this story, the political equation might have looked in a certain way that might be surprising to those of us who are only familiar with the last three or four decades of
Indeed.
The story. And then by the end of this book, when I get to the end of the 1970s and then an epilogue that brings the story very briefly up to the present, we begin to see why it was that the pro-life movement aligned itself with the Republican Party in a way that I would argue was perhaps not a natural fit. It was an alliance that was strategic, and there were perhaps good reasons for it at the time, but it's always been an uneasy alliance as well. And I think it's important for people on both sides to recognize that, to recognize that the current partisan split on abortion is not necessarily a natural one, and that it's the product of historical contingencies.
That's something that I really want to get into in a bit, especially when we delve into the meat of the book. But before we do that, one of the things that I found most fascinating is at the very beginning, your account is extremely even-handed, and it does seem like you take very great pains to use terminology that you justify at the very beginning. In fact, you have a little terminology, a 3 or 4 page justification for what you are using in terminology. In fact, you opt to use pro-life when talking about the pro-life movement, and also when they are in the proper historical context during the timeline of the right-to-life movement. And you also do so with the pro-choice movement, but of course the pro-choice movement never used that terminology per se. Rather, there were a lot of other things that they used to describe themselves when they weren't quite as a cohesive faction, you know, bandied together around, let's say, Planned Parenthood and the Democratic Party. So I want you to talk a little bit about really your choice of terminology for this, because I find that to be interesting, and your justification I think is apt.
Right. I think that for people on both sides of the abortion debate, if they talk to people on the other side, that is, if they're a strong partisan on one side and they talk to someone who's a strong partisan on the other side, they will find out almost immediately that not only can they not agree on the issue at hand, but they often cannot even agree on what they're debating about. And that's reflected
right.
in their terms.
Yeah.
So many people who are strongly pro-choice would prefer not to use the term pro-life to talk about the other side. They might use it reluctantly. They might put it in scare quotes. But many of them are very uncomfortable with that. They might be most comfortable with the term anti-choice, or at the very least, they would use the term anti-abortion. They feel that
right.
that using a term such as pro-life implies that perhaps they're not supportive of life. And on the other side, among some pro-lifers, not all, but but at certainly at some pro-life rallies, people are reluctant to use the term pro-choice, and certainly tend not to use terms like supporters of reproductive rights. They might, in extreme cases, use terms like pro-aborts or something of that nature.
Right,
and,
right.
I think all language in this debate tends to have political connotations, and much of it is politically charged. So the question was, how could I, as a historian, be fair to all of my subjects to tell the story of the right to life movement using the words of many of the people in the movement, but at the same time be perfectly fair not only to their own ideology and position, but also the ideology and position of those that they were arguing against. And so I decided, after some experimentation and talking to a number of people who were varying positions on the abortion issue, that perhaps the only way to do that as a historian would simply be to use the terms that people used at the time, which leads to some confusion, because if you go back to the early 1960s, neither pro-life nor pro-choice were terms that were used. And yet, I think that's why it's most important to not use those terms when describing, say, people who were involved in this debate 50 years ago. Because we use the term pro-choice to describe advocates of liberalizing abortion laws, we're likely to misunderstand these people. Because in the early 1960s, most advocates of abortion law liberalization were men who were not feminists and who were not necessarily grounding their arguments in a woman's right to choose. In fact, that phrase would have been anachronistic at the time. It simply wasn't used. Mm. And instead, they had other arguments about that tended to be utilitarian, about societal good, about medical benefit, about the rights of doctors. There were a number of arguments that they made. But to label those arguments pro-choice is going to be somewhat misleading. And so readers of the book will note, and I state this in my introduction, as you pointed out, but readers of the book will note that it's not until maybe chapter 6 or 7, about 75% of the way through the book, that you get into that you first encounter terms such as pro-choice. And even with the term pro-life, while I think it's probably more in keeping with the views of people who were opposing abortion even in the 50s and 60s to use that term. That is, that even though that term wasn't used in the 1950s, people who opposed abortion did ground their arguments in the value of human life. Nevertheless, I thought, to be consistent, I would use terms that they used at the time. And so early in the book, I use terms like right to life or even simply opponents of abortion before the movement really coalesced around a common term.
Yeah, and I think many individuals that have read the book have recognized and lauded your approach to this. I've read several reviews. Even the New York Times thought that you were very fair in your dealing with the terminology. So I want to talk also. There's a piece within it may have been the terminology, it may have been the introduction, but you mention that there really hasn't been a complete account told of the pro-life movement, about the abortion, the American abortion issue from the pro-life side. And I want to ask you, why is that the case? Because it seems one of those situations where maybe it's the winner that's writing history. You know, the 1973 decision gave some type of justification, some type of brazenness to be able to simply write the history, just like many history books aren't written through the Nazi perspective leading up to World War II.
I think it has to do with the narrative that most historians of the 20th century United States have more or less agreed upon when they look at social and political movements of the past. Hmm. And to be fair to historians, I think there is an interest among many historians of studying conservatives, of studying groups that might have been politically marginalized at a particular point in time. Hmm. But nevertheless, among most historians, there's a general perception that that American history has moved in a rights conscious direction. And there's good reason for that. After all, if you look at the civil rights movement, that has, while I think increasingly over the last couple of years, all of us have been confronted perhaps with the reality of persistent racism in the United States to maybe a greater degree than we realized. Nevertheless, there's a lot of truth to the narrative that the civil rights movement triumphed in accomplishing some of its goals. And there's a lot of truth to the narrative that the women's rights movement of the late 1960s and 1970s permanently changed American society, and the way that we think about gender roles today is very different perhaps from the way that many Americans thought about them in the 1950s. And so there is a general movement toward greater rights consciousness. Now, if you use that framework to understand the abortion debate, the way that story has generally been told is that very restrictive abortion laws were a relic of the late 19th century. The feminist movement challenged those laws. After a brief struggle, they had the major victory in Roe v. Wade. Mm. And yes, there's persistent debate over it, but that's mainly due to religious conservatism, and American society in general has accepted the legality of abortion, and the people who oppose it have been mostly politically marginalized, and to the extent that they've won victories, it's simply a sign of a backlash against women's rights. Right. And that's a great oversimplification in the way that I've described the story, but I don't think it's unfair. I think that's generally the way that the story has been told.
I agree.
Now, the problem with that is that it's very difficult to fit a vibrant pro-life movement into that story. So if the pro-life movement had resisted and had then lost and had disappeared more or less, I think historians would find that perhaps comfortable to study, because that fits into the narrative of backlash. After all, everyone knows who studies American history in detail that there were plenty of people who opposed the civil rights movement at the time. People like George Wallace and the revived Ku Klux Klan and segregationists and others, and they were marginalized and lost. And there have been a few books written about them. As I point out with the pro-life movement, when you start to delve into this story, it doesn't fit the profile of a backlash movement. In fact, what it fits the profile of is a liberal human rights movement that should have won given this trajectory. That is, these were people who were arguing on the same basis as women's rights advocates, civil rights advocates, gay rights advocates. That is, they took a group of people a group that they considered people, that is, the unborn, and said their rights need to be protected in public law. We're standing up for the rights of this group.
Right.
And the reason that they didn't win was because they were in conflict with another group of liberals who were also making rights-based arguments. And in this clash of two liberal human rights movements, one side ended up winning a court victory and the other side did not. But that's very different from the way that the story is often told. And so I think because most historians looking at this debate have gravitated toward the side that they think was the rights conscious movement,
Yeah. They've
studied this from one perspective and have forgotten perhaps that the other side was just as much of a rights conscious movement.
The beginnings of the, let's say, the right to life movement, or the, not even the movement, I should say, the philosophy of protecting the unborn child. The philosophy dates back centuries and centuries before the 20th century, as you've pointed out in your book, and many pro-choicers nowadays will sometimes use it as, you know, as an acidic criticism, and sometimes they'll just simply state it as fact. But you do highlight the fact that the Catholic Church really fueled and was the fire starter of this philosophy, pushing it into the limelight. But they also did something that I've always found to be coming from a secular standpoint, but I certainly understand why they did this and the reasons and the arguments for doing so. But they performed something that was very critical to the success and failures that they experienced in the latter half of the 20th century, which was linking abortion to contraception, the two arguments together in a theological, mostly theological. Argument. So I want you to talk a little bit about that.
At the beginning of the 20th century, there was a general societal consensus against contraception to a degree that I think very few Americans today, outside of a few religious circles, would really understand. So at the beginning of the 20th century, no Protestant church, no Protestant denomination endorsed the use of contraception. The Catholic Church certainly did not. And contraception was difficult to get. Its advertisement was illegal in many places due to the Comstock laws. And so at the beginning of the 20th century, the Catholic stance against contraception did not strike any group as anomalous. In fact, the opposition to contraception, to the extent that it was talked about, was really not identified as exclusively Catholic. But that began to change in the 1920s. In the 1920s, Margaret Sanger started what at the time was called the American Birth Control League. It later became Planned Parenthood. And laws against contraception began to be overturned, sometimes by court order. Contraception became more widely available, and some Protestant denominations began changing their stances on contraception in the early 1930s. Most of the mainline Protestant churches did accept the need for contraception in at least some cases at that point in the 1930s. And so at that point, the Catholic stance against contraception started to look like it was out of touch with the mainstream. And at the time, the Catholic Church considered contraception or the legalization of contraception or the public acceptance of contraception to be the greater more immediate threat than abortion. There were relatively few Americans in the 1930s and 1940s that were advocating for the legalization of abortion. There were a handful, but not that many. They tended to be politically marginalized. And yet contraception was widely discussed. The laws against contraception were rapidly being overturned. And so the Catholic Church mounted a campaign against that on the ground that the acceptance of contraception was an assault on the value of human life. That is, that by attempting to stop the formation of human life, that people were disrespecting what it meant to be human. Now, as I said, according to public opinion polls today, very few Americans tend to be persuaded by that sort of reasoning.
Right.
There are a few, but not very many. And so even for most pro-lifers today, that's not necessarily a persuasive argument. But that is the way that a lot of Catholics looked at the question in the 1940s and 1950s. And furthermore, they also predicted that the acceptance of abortion would naturally follow from the acceptance of contraception. That is, if people adopted the view that sex without pregnancy was a worthy goal, they would then find it to be a very short step from attempting to stop a pregnancy to attempting to correct that if a pregnancy resulted. And so when an abortion liberalization campaign did begin, and when some of the people who were active in that campaign in the early to mid-1960s actually invoked the acceptance of contraception and argued that they were simply building on that, then many Catholic pro-lifers and could look at that and say, see, this is exactly what we predicted. It's unfolding exactly as Catholics have been expecting since the 1930s. And they furthermore said that further disrespect for human life is going to result, that abortion is not the last step, but simply one step in this chain, that first you have contraception, then you have abortion, then you're going to start to have infanticide and other forms of disrespect for human life. Now, as I said, a lot of pro-lifers today wouldn't necessarily accept all of those arguments. Some would, but many would not. And by the mid-1960s, that argument that the Catholic Church was making was becoming a liability for the movement because it tended to prevent the movement's ideology from being taken very seriously by non-Catholics, especially Protestants and some Jews who had accepted contraception, but who still had reservations about abortion, but they were reluctant to join a Right to Life campaign that was still very heavily Catholic and very heavily tied to this particular argument.
So I have a book on my shelf over here that is, it's kind of an exercise in fantasy, but it's sort of a revisionist history book where a number of historians will pretend as though things happened differently throughout history. You know, Hitler wasn't killed, the Axis won, or Abraham Lincoln wasn't assassinated, or there's still slavery in America, these sorts of fanciful arguments. And some of them are very fun, and some of them are rather silly. But if I had my druthers, I would add another hypothetical into this history book and ask the question, what if the Catholic Church did not link the argument for abortion to contraception? Do you believe that the Right to Life movement would be stronger than it is today? And we'll get to, you know, the conditions of it today, but do you believe that it would be stronger than it is today? Do you think that 1973 would have happened in the same way? I know this is very speculative and, you know, you're a historian, you deal in facts, but I'm curious. I have to ask this question.
Well, there are a lot of counterfactuals that we could look at regarding the pro-life movement. But with that particular counterfactual, I'm not sure it would have made as big of a difference as what we might think. Now, it's very hard to say, but certainly that connection with contraception hurt the Right to Life campaign in the mid to late 1960s. Mm. And I would say that it was one factor among several that led to the rapid spread of abortion liberalization laws. Those were not full legalization laws, but they were compromise measures that allowed for abortion in a number of cases of medical necessity, of perceived medical necessity that went beyond simply saving a woman's life.
Yeah.
And so there were a number of states, starting with Colorado and California, but even some states in the South, including North Carolina and eventually Georgia and others, that legalized abortion in limited cases. And those laws tended to be popular with Protestants at the time, who were somewhat uncomfortable with abortion, but who also resisted the Catholic Church's arguments. And so I think one could make a very good case that those laws of the late 1960s might not have been passed so rapidly had the Catholic Church not marginalized itself on some of these other issues. But by the early 1970s, the Right to Life movement had completely recalibrated. And so in the early 1970s, pro-life movement was working very hard to disassociate itself from any discussion of contraception. And it was winning political victories as a result. So by the time that Roe v. Wade came, I don't really think that contraception was much of a factor in that debate. The debate had moved on. And what happened with Roe v. Wade was that after a series of political victories at the legislature and at the ballot box at the state level, pro-lifers lost an important court case and, in essence, lost everything with that, or at least that's the way that it seemed. So that was really based on different issues. And so I think the contraception part of the story is important for understanding what was happening in the 1960s and then how the Right to Life movement quickly learned from some of its perceived mistakes and recalibrated. Now, there is another side to this, and I deal with that briefly in my epilogue, which is that there are some conservative Catholics. So you're asking the question from the perspective of someone who sees the link with contraception as a liability, because you think there may have been some merit to the pro-life arguments based on human rights, based on a person's right to life, but this argument about, you know, what can be done during the sex act itself, I mean, that seems to be much more theological, much less tied to any principles of justice. And that's the way most Americans would probably look at it today. But there is an argument that I try to take seriously in the epilogue, which some conservative Catholics make today. And they have essentially argued that the pro-life movement was too quick to give up on that particular argument. And the problem is that the pro-life movement, while winning a lot of converts to its cause based on principles of justice, has been somewhat stymied in really ridding the country of abortion, or even radically driving down the abortion rate. The abortion rate has been dropping for the past 25 years, but there are limits to that, that even after 40 plus years of discomfort on the issue, there are still nearly a million abortions per year that occur in the United States. And so there are some pro-lifers who say that it's going to be difficult to really fight abortion without taking on a larger sexual revolution and a larger liberalized sexual ethic. That is, if the majority of Americans are committed to the idea that sex can be separated from marriage and separated from procreation, then what is going to happen when contraceptives fail, or what is going to happen when a pregnancy results in people didn't intend for it to happen? They might have, and there are numerous examples of this, that people who consider themselves opposed to abortion find themselves in a difficult situation and justify, at least at the moment, an abortion. And so there is some merit to that argument, even if you're not persuaded by the particular line of reasoning that Catholics of the mid-20th century made. There is, I think, good reason to believe that there are going to be limits to what the pro-life movement can accomplish, as long as they're having to operate within the parameters of a widely accepted liberalized sexual ethic that attempts to completely dissociate sex from any sort of procreative responsibility.
Yeah, I certainly have heard that argument, you know, being around the March to Life and pro-life movement for quite some time. And the membership of these movements, at least, you know, even nowadays in many universities, I would say by and large, not exclusively, but by and large, have been Catholic, some Protestant as well, but just in the actual Students for Life, as it's called, not necessarily so much in the Right to Life, the statewide, but Students for Life, I've actually experienced a lot of Catholics making that argument too. So I know we've been moving sort of decade by decade to closer and closer to modern time, but I did want to take one step back for a second and emphasize one thing that I found very fascinating, and that was the sectarian lines that were really more religious, somewhat ethno-religious, that had very delineated positions on abortion. You had rabbinical leaders, Jews, that were considered the most radical, and I don't want to say pro-abort, but they were advocating for abortion to protect women's health, and there were arguments to be made about population control and things like that. You had Protestants, which you positioned somewhat in the middle, some were for, some were against, and this was still a time where it was women's health, sometimes population control, utilitarian, societal good sorts of arguments. And then you had the Catholics, mostly, almost exclusively doctors, as you illustrate, in the early 20th century. I don't think that a lot of pro-lifers or pro-choicers really realized that the central piece of, or one of the central pieces in the pro-life movement today, being Protestants, non-Catholics, who are very often, if they are practicing their faith, very often pro-life, were really confused in the center.
Right. I think that is a surprise to a lot of conservative evangelical Protestants. And so today in the Protestant world, there tends to be a polarization among Protestants. On the one hand, you have mainline or liberal Protestants, and that would include Episcopalians, members of the United Church of Christ, which was President Obama's home denomination, some Methodists, and some others. And then on the other side, you tend to have conservative evangelicals, which would be associated very strongly with the Southern Baptist Convention, most Pentecostals, a number of other conservative Christians of various sorts. And for the last 35 years or more, we've seen a cultural polarization between those groups. So on the side of the mainline, you have universal ordination of women, you have a general embrace of gay rights, a willingness to perform same-sex marriages, that sort of thing. And then on the conservative evangelical side, you tend to see a fairly strong alliance with the Christian right. Of course, there are numerous exceptions. These are broad generalities.
Right.
But in this context, for people who have been paying attention to politics for less than 30 or 40 years, that is, you know, they're on the younger side of the age spectrum, perhaps. They
like myself.
Right, exactly. And I'm not that old either. But anyway, they tend to just assume that the liberal Protestants will be pro-choice, and of course the conservative evangelicals have always been pro-life. And what I point out in this book is it's actually much more complicated. First of all, at the beginning, the movement was overwhelmingly Catholic. The evangelicals weren't really paying attention to this. And then when the first Protestants were recruited to the movement, many of the most prominent figures were actually liberal Protestants who were attracted to the movement because of its liberal human rights ideology. So yes, they tended to be progressive in their politics and certainly progressive in their religion, and they view the pro-life movement as very much part of this. But the evangelicals were for the most part never fully pro-choice, but they tended to take a somewhat moderate conservative position on the issue, saying that abortion was problematic, and yet they were unwilling to affirm categorically that life began at conception. They tended to view the pro-life movement as a Catholic movement, and they had reservations about getting involved there. And so I argue that the evangelical involvement in the movement began in stages. The first stage came in 1970 with the passage of several full-scale legalization bills that legalized elective abortion up through the second trimester. And so New York State passed one of those. There were a few other states that did as well. And at that point, some conservative evangelical Protestants began writing against abortion. And then Roe v. Wade, of course, was another major moment. A third major moment came in the mid to late 1970s when the evangelical theologian Francis Schaeffer mobilized a number of conservative Protestants to oppose abortion. And so by the early 1980s, the pro-life movement had gained a strong foothold in conservative evangelical circles. That is, most Southern Baptist pastors and most other conservative evangelicals were beginning to identify their position as strongly pro-life. Now, what's interesting is that while today the pro-life movement may be even more strongly associated with conservative evangelicals than with conservative Catholics, though both are very much involved, even today, I think the nature of the involvement is somewhat different, so that there are certain organizations, certain pro-life organizations, that still tend to be very strongly Catholic. And if you go to the March for Life, for instance, you run into a lot of Catholics.
Absolutely, yeah.
And there are other organizations, perhaps, that tend to be more strongly evangelical Protestant. There are some organizations that attract both, but even today, I think there are at least slight differences between the way that conservative evangelicals approach the issue and the way the conservative Catholics approach the issue, even though both groups would strongly oppose abortion.
Hmm. And at what point in time, because this I think is a very important piece of the narrative as well, at what point in time did we really move to the abortion on demand argument from saving women's lives and the population control? Well, population control and the eugenics programs really fell out of style with, actually, from what I understand and from, I think, what I've read in your book, there were some individuals that were discussing the possibility of this even in the 1950s. But of course, with the tie to Nazism and eugenics programs and the horrors of the Holocaust, those sorts of arguments did die out. But we made a shift over the latter half of the 20th century to abortion on demand, and abortion being seen as an evil, but a necessary evil in order to save the woman's life, to just simply, it's just a clump of cells. We have entirely and unabashedly, and maybe I'm, you know, tipping my hand a bit, dehumanized the fetus, sometimes from start to almost birth.
Yes. Well, I think the crucial shift occurred in the late 1960s. So as late as the early 1960s, most advocates of abortion law liberalization conceded that the fetus might be a human life. Alan Guttmacher, for example, said remarkably at one point in the early 1960s that he didn't like killing, but he believed that there were some causes that were worth killing for.
Guttmacher being the Planned Parenthood head,
right,
in the 1960s.
Exactly.
Yes.
And he said, I don't like to do abortions, but he believed that a woman's life was more important than the life of a fetus. Yeah. And it was a remarkable statement in some ways, because it seemed to essentially concede the possibility of the humanity of the fetus. And yet, even though he was advocating for liberalized abortion law, he was still suggesting there should be parameters around this that should be allowed only in certain cases of medical necessity, only for certain reasons. Well, in 1967, the National Organization for Women, reflecting a larger cultural shift in the feminist movement, endorsed the repeal of all abortion laws, saying that a woman should have the right to decide whether to be pregnant or not. And that became the rallying cry of Now, it led to a split in the organization. So there were some pro-life women who left Now and branded themselves as feminist pro-lifers, but outside the feminist mainstream as a result of this. But Betty Friedan and other leaders of the feminist movement began saying that a woman would not be fully liberated until she had the full control over her own body.
Right.
And that certainly being forced to bear a pregnancy to term was, in their view, a violation of women's rights. Well, that essentially led to the dehumanization of the fetus, because when people embraced that rhetoric, then it became very awkward to concede any humanity to the fetus at all. And
right.
And some of the more extreme statements about this being simply as a clump of cells, and that abortion should be illegal for all 9 months, those, and not everyone embraced that, certainly, but there were some pro-choice leaders, a number of prominent pro-choice leaders in the early 1970s who did. And it was, I think, an outgrowth of a commitment that they had to a woman's right to choose, that once this became about something other than simply a woman's health or balancing competing interests, a woman versus another human life, then this became a matter of an absolute rights commitment. That is, that a woman had the right to choose in every situation, right up to the end of pregnancy, and that's what some people said. Now, some people would stop at the end of the second trimester, so there was some division within the movement on that. But certainly in its more extreme manifestation in the early 1970s, there was a radical dehumanization of the fetus. Now, Roe v. Wade attempted, rather unsuccessfully, I would argue, but attempted to preserve some semblance of balance between these competing interests. But in practice, while the majority opinion in Roe did give lip service to the fact that the state had a compelling interest in pregnancy during the third trimester, still it overwhelmingly shifted the balance of the conversation to a woman's right to bodily autonomy and the corresponding idea that the fetus had no constitutional rights.
1973 rolls around, and there is a major and stunning defeat that the pro-life movement experiences at the hands of the Supreme Court. And it isn't until late 1970s, early 1980s, where it starts to pick back up again with a number of conservative evangelical leaders. And you have individuals like Helms and Falwell trying to pressure Republican leaders to change their ways and support anti-abortion measures. So this is sort of a revolution, well, the Reagan revolution brought about a brand new revitalization to the pro-life movement in a way that really hadn't happened, you know, immediately after 1973.
Yes, the pro-life movement was strong in terms of membership in right. the mid to late 1970s, but certainly the election of Ronald Reagan and the corresponding developments after Reagan's election as a result of that gave the pro-life movement more hope for victories in Washington than it had before. And in particular, what it did was to give the pro-life movement a hope that they could overturn Roe by changing the Supreme Court. During the 1970s, from 1973 all the way to the very end of the decade, nearly all pro-life organizations in the United States were committed to passage of what they called a human life amendment to the Constitution. They thought the way to overturn Roe would be by passing a constitutional amendment that would protect human life from the moment of conception. And this was a longer-term strategy than changing the Supreme Court. Reagan's election, followed by the appointment of conservative justices, gave the movement some hope that they could overturn Roe more quickly. Now, in actual fact, what happened is they didn't. They expected that they would overturn Roe in 1992. Instead, what happened was that the Supreme Court affirmed Roe by a 5-4 majority, and two of those five justices were Reagan appointees, Anthony Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor. So the strategy of attempting to rely on conservative justices to overturn Roe so far has not succeeded. Now, that's not to say that it could never succeed. There may come a day when it would succeed, but pro-lifers have had mixed success with Republicans. Now, the consequence, though, of that judicial strategy has been a greater political polarization in the United States. So on the one hand, you have Democrats who are absolutely committed to appointing justices who will affirm Roe v. Wade. And since the early 1990s, every Democratic nominated Supreme Court justice has been consistently in favor of affirming the essence of Roe. And one would assume that that will continue indefinitely. There's no question in anybody's mind that had Hillary Clinton been elected president, the person that she would have nominated for the open seat would not have been someone like Neil Gorsuch. It would have been either Merrick Garland or someone that was even more strongly committed to affirming Roe. That's simply expected. On the other side, pro-lifers, at least in the early years of this strategy, had only about a 50% success rate in appointing anti-Roe justices. So Reagan's record, George H.W. Bush's record of appointments was mixed in that. You had with George H.W. Bush, Clarence Thomas, but then you also had David Souter, who was on the other side of this issue. And so in recent years, and we could see that reflected in the election of last year, of 2016, the pro-life movement had and its allies in the Republican Party have been absolutely insistent that only judges who will show reasonable probability of wanting to roll back Roe will be nominated. And that has polarized the abortion debate in a way that is largely unprecedented. In the 1970s, there was ideological polarization in the United States over abortion, but that was not consistently reflected in partisan polarization.
Yeah.
But today, it is reflected in partisan polarization.
Before we reach, well, you have touched upon briefly the state of things as it is right now, but I do want to make sort of a sidebar here in regards to one of the New York Times review. It's about a 1 or 2 page review by a Miss Kristen Dombek, which I'll link to the show notes below. A favorable review, I think, in general, but she does end with somewhat of an interesting statement. And I'll quote it here, just to refresh your memory. "And when history reaches its familiar conclusion, when both parties were split on abortion, religious conservatives like Jesse Helms and Jerry Falwell pressured Republican leaders to abort abortion, and liberal Democrats who already abhorred abortion had to switch parties. Williams deals only swiftly with the gender issue so important to many activists on both sides of the issue now. As a result, some readers will find his history selective. He leaves it largely up to us to decide what to make of the relation between evangelicals' turn towards family values and the language of justice and genocide that continues to motivate some to walk into clinics with guns and bombs." I detect a slight desire from Ms. Dombek of perhaps a prescriptive sort of lesson concluding your narrative of the pro-life movement rather than a descriptive one, sort of a guidance for the readers. Maybe I'm misinterpreting it, but she makes a mention that perhaps you are leaving out some of these very common gender issues, and also the socially charged issues, the language of justice and genocide, as she says. What do you make of that comment?
First of all, I was very grateful for that review. I think she did a remarkable, it was a remarkably fair-minded review, especially given the fact that as she mentioned in the review, she herself is pro-choice. So I was impressed that she was willing to read a book that, as I said, I try to be objective, but I think also sympathetic to the pro-life side. And there are certainly some people on the pro-choice side that might find some arguments that I make in this book a little disconcerting. So I would commend her for that. But I can understand where she's coming from, because I think for a lot of pro-choicers, this history is very surprising. They're surprised that I don't talk as much about women's rights. And I do actually talk about women's rights a fair amount in the book. But it comes at a later stage of the narrative. And the reason for that is that I'm trying to be faithful to the historical narrative as it played out, that for much of the history that I'm describing, women's rights was not an important issue for either side. That is, most of the abortion law liberalization advocates in the early 1960s were men. They were not necessarily sympathetic to women's rights concerns, although, I mean, maybe moderately so. But this was not necessarily the driving impetus for what they were doing. And on the pro-life side, I do concede that the movement, while always attracting a large number of women, tended to be led by men until pro-lifers decided, in reaction to what was going on in the abortion rights movement, that they, and the feminist movement in particular, that they needed to showcase women's voices to a greater degree. And women in the pro-life movement were saying the same thing. And so women's voices emerged. And I do describe that story, but I think some people may find that a little frustrating that they don't see that until later in the book. But even more so, what I think she's saying is that she's not quite sure how to connect the narrative that I describe that goes in detail up to 1973 and then in rather short order over the last 40 years. She's not quite sure how to connect that narrative to the contemporary moment, where she sees pro-lifers as much more conservative, linked probably in her view to policies that she would view as not necessarily supportive of women's rights, linked to conservative religious platforms to a certain extent, and also, of course, what about the question, what about violence, what about people who over the last 25 years have at periodic moments, not regularly, but on occasion, kill people in order to make their point about abortion. And so I can understand those questions. And I briefly dealt with a few of those in the conclusion, but I think she's right that I skimmed over them, partly because I was trying to present a moment in the pro-life movement when things looked very different. Now, that leads to the question, okay, if I did connect the dots, what would I say? How do you get from this story
exactly.
where things look very different to the modern story? And I think the answer is that the pro-life movement has become much more diverse, much more fragmented than it was in the early 1970s. It's actually more difficult, I think, to write a history of the pro-life movement in the last over the last 25 years, just because there are so many pro-life organizations, many of which are very much at odds with each other. It's not as easy to find the same core group of people as you could in the late 60s and early 1970s. And so today you can find pro-lifers of all stripes. As you probably know, you can find Catholics who are very conservative. You can find some who are opposed to contraception. You can find liberal Catholics in the movement. You can find conservative evangelicals who are strongly Republican. You can find a handful of evangelicals who are actually quite liberal in their politics, but also who are pro-life. You can find a few secular people. You can certainly find some Jews, many of whom are Orthodox Jews, but some of whom are not. You can find other groups. If you do a quick search of pro-life groups on the internet, you even find you certainly find Feminists for Life. You find even groups of gays and lesbians who are pro-life. So the movement, I think, has become much more diffuse, and it has also become much more a part of our partisan political landscape. And many people make the mistake, I think, of confusing pro-life activists with Republican politicians. So who Republican politicians will oppose abortion. Almost all of the Republicans in Congress, with very few exceptions, oppose abortion. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they are committed to the larger set of pro-life values. And I think that's something that people often forget. And then, of course, there are going to be people on the fringes of the movement, or even maybe not fully connected to the movement at all, who have engaged in violence or who endorse the use of violence. And even if large numbers of people within the movement, the mainstream of the movement, repudiates that, it still tarnishes the movement's image, and the movement's rhetoric is sometimes blamed for that. And so I think it's important to acknowledge these things. It's important to acknowledge where we are, but I think it's also important to recognize that the modern story is much more complicated. It can't be summed up in sort of a 30-second soundbite or anything of that nature, and that the complications of the modern movement don't necessarily negate, or shouldn't even necessarily call into question, some of the core values claims of that earlier phase of the movement, which, to a large extent, I would say, are still preserved, at least in parts of the pro-life movement today.
Absolutely. Yes, I agree. Do you see any natural alliances that the pro-life movement can and should establish that they haven't already, especially seeing its very illustrious and diverse past? And you've illustrated that now there are many, perhaps non-religious, maybe not many, but some non-religious and non-conservatives that have recognized the pro-life message as a civil right, and that the fetus should be protected. Do you see any of these alliances that simply have not been leveraged that the pro-life movement may in the future or should?
Yes, I think that the pro-life movement has an advantage in the fact that millennials, younger Americans, tend to be very energized by rights claims, and the pro-life movement is based on a rights claim that's easy to understand, and that a lot of people find persuasive. And so I think that the movement could probably make alliances to a degree that it has not among some people who are otherwise politically apathetic, and even people who identify themselves as liberals who are energized by this rights-based claim. Now, the problem the pro-life movement faces is that its largest organizations tend to be closely tied to partisan politics. That is, they're interested in a political goal, that is overturning Roe v. Wade, which is only going to be accomplished through politics. And so they're naturally going to look for political allies for that. And the only allies that they've found in large numbers have been in the Republican Party. The Democratic Party has been on record for nearly 40 years now of opposing the repeal of Roe v. Wade, and they've become even more strongly committed to that cause in recent years. So I think on the part of a lot of pro-life veterans, there is great reluctance to welcome into the movement those who would contribute to the election of people who would perpetuate the legalization of abortion. If your primary goal is to protect the unborn in American law, protect their right to life and end legal abortion in the United States, then supporting politicians who are committed to the opposite goal would seem to be counterproductive. And so I think that's a dilemma for the movement, and there are no easy answers there, because there are a lot of people who would be sympathetic to at least some aspects of the pro-life movement, who are deeply uncomfortable with abortion, who like the idea of a rights-based movement, and who can see the possibility, at least, that the fetus is a human life and probably should be protected. There are a lot of Americans, I think, who feel that way. Not all of them always vote Republican. And so then the question for the movement is, can you make these broader alliances? Can you become a big tent, so to speak, welcoming in people of all partisan and ideological stripes who might come to their pro-life convictions from different angles and different perspectives? Would the movement be comfortable with that? And I think some pro-lifers would say yes, and some pro-lifers would hesitate. I think everyone in the movement would like more people on their side. Who wouldn't? But then the question is, even if all of these people are opposed to abortion, and even if all these people value unborn human life, are they necessarily working toward the same goal? That is, some pro-lifers would be more comfortable, say, volunteering at a crisis pregnancy center and offering women help to encourage them to carry their pregnancies to term. They might be uncomfortable working for the election of Republican politicians. And so that leads to the question, what really constitutes pro-life values? Is the person who is working at the pro-life crisis pregnancy center, but who is very uncomfortable with the Republican Party, is that person equally a pro-life activist as someone who might work within the more traditional National Right to Life Committee, which has a partisan litmus test?
I think my listeners would be very disappointed with me if I didn't ask one final question. I know that you are a historian and not an oracle. I want to know what you believe the feasibility, the path forward for the pro-life movement, the most successful outcome towards their goals. Would they be better off continuing to attack Roe versus Wade, overturning it, and perhaps creating a federal ban on abortions, or abrogating this responsibility to states' rights? I hear from leaders politically within the movement and without that care about this. I've heard both ways, and I'm curious, from someone who has studied this for quite a long time, what do you see the most realistic outcome for success for the pro-life movement?
Yes, and I should, I guess, preface this by saying that historians tend to be terrible prophets. We just, we don't really know the future any more than anyone else. But I guess based on what I've studied, I think that every time the pro-life movement has overreached in a sense, that there's been a real possibility or a real anxiety among people on the other side that Roe v. Wade might be overturned or that abortion would be restricted in some way, there's often a backlash. On the other hand, when the pro-life movement has been able to focus the issue on the humanity of the fetus, especially when they're talking about late-term abortions and 20 years ago partial birth abortion, that they tend to win those sorts of debates. So based on that, I believe that if Roe v. Wade were overturned in the short term, there would be a backlash in at least some quarters, and a federal ban would not be possible at that moment. So we're almost, even if you're advocating a federal ban, you're almost by necessity talking about a two-step process. It's difficult to imagine a federal ban being passed, that is becoming part of the Constitution, which politically seems like an impossible goal today, without a change in the political climate and without Roe v. Wade being overturned. So I think Roe v. Wade has for the past 25 years been always on the verge of being overturned. That is, we've usually had a 5-4 split in the Supreme Court. And the question has always been, well, will one justice, the right justice, step off the bench at just the right moment and be replaced? And so there's the status of Roe v. Wade has always been somewhat precarious, even for those who believe that it's that it will never be overturned. And I'm not sure how many people really believe that. I think even among pro-choicers, there's a real anxiety about the status of Roe. Will it be overturned or not? I think everyone would have to admit that it's always tenuous, because you're just asking the question, can you get to a simple majority on the Supreme Court and get the right court case to the Supreme Court at the right time when you have the right five justices in place? Now, what's interesting to me is that we have seen a near return to the immediate pre-Roe era, that is, in terms of the abortion rate in the United States. It very closely mirrors now 1972, early 1973. We have seen a steady reduction in the number of abortions in the United States, coupled with a regional polarization on the issue. So one-third of abortions in the United States are performed in California and New York, and the abortion rate in New York is much higher than that in Mississippi, where there's only one clinic. There are several states, including Mississippi and both South and North Dakota, I think, where you have only one clinic. There are other states where you have only a few clinics. And so we're already seeing this return to states' rights more or less on abortion. And the repeal of Roe would simply ratify that. But given the nation's polarization on abortion, I think it's highly unlikely that we would see at any point in the immediate future a majority in or a supermajority. It would require a supermajority, but a supermajority in support of a federal ban on abortion. I think we're still a long way off from that. That's not to say that it couldn't happen, but what it would require would be a national change in the cultural view of abortion. And that means for people who are on the pro-life side, obviously there's a lot more work to do to reach that stage.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but you did say that my listeners can email you if they decide to bet on the wrong horse.
I'm always happy to receive email.
I promise you an hour, and sometimes it happens when we have such good guests that I find fascinating, and I know my listeners will. We'd like to keep them on. Eke out just a couple more minutes, but I would like to wrap it up. Thank you very much for joining us in the program. I'm glad that you were able to highlight some of these key moments within your book, and that you have created such a wonderful piece that I think will be important to the legacy of the pro-life movement, and I think is important for those who are pro-choice to read as well. You, as I said before, have a very even-keeled approach that is very difficult to find even among historian. It is a commendable achievement, and very happy to place this book within our show notes to make sure that our listeners are able to pick it up. Remember, listeners, this is called Defenders of the Unborn, the Pro-Life Movement Before Roe v. Wade. You can also remember that this is the podcast that places you on the front line in the war of ideas until the next battle. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michael.
Way down inside of me, darling, I have only one desire, and that one desire is you. And I know nobody else ain't gonna do.